History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've realized over the years that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take that initiative, ask a few questions, and then to patiently listen as stories from long, long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. The story of the cruiser USS Indianapolis is one that is both tragic and inspiring. Its sinking is known as the worst sea disaster in American history, a moniker that even found its way into the title of the best-selling book by Sarah Vladeck and Lynn Vincent. We're going to hear from Sarah in a moment, but the reason we're talking about the Indianapolis today is that the final survivor from the ship sinking is being honored on July 7th with a statue that will not only celebrate his legacy, but that of his ship. Harold Bray is Benicia, California's hometown hero, and on the evening of July 7th, you can join Harold and what I'm sure is going to be a hearty crowd when that statue is dedicated. Before we listen to Harold's memories from the Indianapolis, let's talk to Sarah Vladeck, who started attending USS Indianapolis reunions nearly a quarter century ago. She produced an award-winning documentary about the tragedy and then, of course, wrote that best-selling book, Indianapolis. Sarah joins us now. What can you tell us about this latest chapter with the statue being dedicated in Benicia, California, July 7th.
This whole thing came about because Harold Bray, who is the last living survivor of USS Indianapolis, is a resident of Benicia. And for most of, you know, in the Northern California Bay Area know that Benicia is right, you know, outside of Mare Island in Vallejo. And that's the final sailing place of USS Indianapolis. That's where she left when she was carrying components of the atomic bomb. And so Harold was actually not from there at that time. He was from Michigan. But after the war, he settled down in Benicia, and he became a staple of the community. He actually became a police officer and a beloved police officer. And just, you know, everyone from that community has stories about Harold Bray growing up, how he got them out of trouble, or how he, you know, he was kind of a father figure for a lot of, we call them hoodlums, I guess you could say, but troublemakers, and you know, now they all speak of him fondly. And so I think the community just wanted to honor not just his service to the country and to the Navy, but to his service to the community for decades following the war. And so they put together this fundraising effort, and there's going to be this beautiful bronze statue, and the statue is of Harold, and then surrounding it is a monument to USS Indianapolis, and that will be in by the Veterans Building in Benicia, downtown.
So this is going to be Friday, July 7th, and anybody listening right now can come?
Yep, it is open to the public. It starts at 6 p.m. Bring a chair. It's on the kind of the lawn quarters by the Commandant's quarters in front of the clock tower. So if you're familiar with that area, there's a big grass lawn, and they're going to unveil the statue there. So that happens at 6, but, you know, due to traffic and all that, we encourage folks to get there early. And, you know, it'll be a really nice event.
So, Sarah, nobody has done more than you have to preserve the history of the Indianapolis. And I believe, was it 137 veterans you interviewed?
I wish. It was 107 that I interviewed on camera. And then over the years, I interviewed a couple more that weren't on camera. But and then quite a few of the family members who were lost, for the sailors who were lost at sea. So, of course, couldn't interview them, but their families who still carried their legacy and do their best to honor their, you know, fathers and uncles and cousins and whatnot. So I was able to interview them as well, and they've really incredible job, these families, in preserving Indianapolis legacy.
Yeah, so if people haven't seen the documentary film that started this journey for you, or at least really brought it to the rest of us with USS Indianapolis, the legacy, they can find that in anywhere. People can dial up films online, they can read your book, but now we're down to one. Harold is the last one. And I'm sure over the years, as you've stayed engaged with this group of survivors, you have to have imagined the day when it would be down to one, or ultimately the day where it's down to none. What do you appreciate about Harold and what he represents as the last living link to that story?
Well, Harold, you know, I've known Harold now for over 22 years, and throughout that time became close with him and his family. And really, you know, like you mentioned, you know, starting with knowing over 100 of these men and now down to one, it's like losing grandparents for over a decade, actually 2 decades. But Harold has always been among those who is very special. And what he embodies really is the young sailor that went aboard Indianapolis. I mean, he was a teenager when he went aboard the ship. He was just turned 18 by a couple weeks. And they, you know, that was his first time on a Navy vessel. And so really that represents so many of the young sailors that went off to war and, you know, saw the ocean or saw, you know, giant ships or fleets for the very first time. And, you know, he came home. And then what he did and accomplished in his life, you know, he talks about how he was too young to die. He had too much to do. And when the men that didn't come home, he felt an obligation, he said it many times, to live for them. And so he, you know, dedicated a life to service and to doing what he could to make the community better and to helping those he could. And I appreciate that so much about, you know, Harold. And he gives the best darn hugs of all of them. So. You know, he's just very special to all of us, and we're so thankful we still have him.
Amen to that. Again, July 7th at 6 p.m. is when that statue honoring Harold Bray and the USS Indianapolis will be unveiled in Benicia, California. We'll hear more from Sarah Vladek before we're done, but if you've never heard Harold Bray's story before, and actually, even if you have, let's go back to his memory of December 7th, 1941, in his native Ramsey, Michigan.
You guys get to Tinian, and you see them unload this precious cargo, this top secret package.
Yeah. We didn't know what it was, though. We didn't know till we got in a hospital in the Philippines what we had, what we did.
And when you're leaving Tinian, as I understand it, McVeigh requested an escort and was denied?
And he refused.
Uh-huh.
Didn't need one.
Didn't need one because there shouldn't be any submarines where you're going.
Well, they figured we could outrun any sub. She was pretty fast.
Yeah.
But you didn't know a sub was around, so she shot us third day out of Tinian.
Well, why was it so important to you to serve your country, to join the Navy? Where did that come from?
Well, mostly all my friends were older than me, and they were all enlisting. I couldn't wait to be 17. I was still in high school. I got to the 12th grade, and I got into December, and I finally got my dad talked into signing me in. And I got in and went to Great Lakes for a boot camp. At that time, we had 3 months of boot camp, I think, 3 or 4 months of boot camp. And I went straight from boot camp to the ship.
Was boot camp challenging for you?
It was different.
Yeah?
The way I was brought up, kind of family close, you know. I enlisted, there was nothing but guys. Everybody was going at that time. There's nobody holding your hand. I mean, you just did what you were told, and you better do it right the first time. But it was the way I was raised, that's how I was raised. And it wasn't too hard to get used to it in service. Do what you're told to do, and no questions asked, you know, just had to do it. You ate better, that's for sure.
Uh-huh.
Where we were in northern Michigan, it was, I look back at it, we were brought up pretty poor. Everybody worked in the mines, and there wasn't much money, so we just lived with it. We learned a lot by being raised like that.
Didn't take anything for granted.
No. Well, as soon as I got in the Navy, it was a big change to be living like that. Never ate so good. That's what I remember most about it. Getting to boot camp and his table full of food, I couldn't understand where that came from.
Had you had any experience on the water before you joined the Navy?
Well, we lived by Lake Superior there, and we had a place on a lake. We had 20 acres on a Lake Ogibek, which was about 30 miles from the home. But we were always around water. We had rafts and boats and made our own stuff. Yeah. But it was interesting growing up. looking back on it, it was a good learning experience every day. It was different. It was always different. Nothing was there for you. You had to make your own way of life, you know. Even as close as our family was, it was always trying to push you out, learning yourself, you know. And I never regretted any of it. It was good for me to grow up that way. I appreciate what I have today because of that.
Yeah, amen. You know, and along those lines, too, I guess I should ask you, before you got in the Navy, I know you did that at a very young age, but before that, as you're growing up, did you have some thoughts in your head, hey, someday, here's the career I'm going to have, or the things I'm going to do, or the man I'm going to become?
Well, that's because the war was on by the time I got to like 13, 14, mm-hmm. and everybody was going, and everything was changing. The way of life was changing from the close-knit family to everything was spread out. You know, it was just a learning experience. Almost every day was different, and I couldn't wait to get into service. My dad was in it, the First World War, and all my uncles, my mother's family was a big family, had 11 kids, and all them guys were in the Army or the Navy or something. I just couldn't wait to get there, so I finally made it.
But even the day that you finished up boot camp was a significant day in our country's history.
Yeah, President Roosevelt died that day.
April 12th?
12th, yeah. I remember that, but the whole thing was a new experience. Every day was an experience to me. Everybody was wide open, and I was having a good time.
I bet. Well, I was struck in thinking about your story. If the Indianapolis isn't hit by a kamikaze at Okinawa, it's not back here in California for you to get aboard.
No.
And take the components of the nuclear bomb to Tinian, yeah. And then everything that happened after that. But when you first laid eyes on that heavy cruiser, the Indianapolis, what was your first impression?
I couldn't believe it was a monster ship. We were in a dry dock when I got there. And it was almost as long as the dry dock. It was 700 feet or something like that. It was really amazing. Everything after that was all new to me. It was just amazing. I just enjoyed the whole thing because I was away from home and on my own. It was a good time for me.
You're a youngster. You're 18 years old. Were there older guys on the ship?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of took you under their wing?
Well, matter of fact, I was just looking at this today. Pappy Goff, he was older, and somehow, some reason, hooked up with me and brought me along pretty good. As far as the ship goes, he made sure I was didn't get into trouble, and I learned a lot from him. We were in the water together after that, too, so, you know, he lived through that.
So, I know this is a long time ago, 75 years ago. You get on that ship right here in the Bay Area. Did you have any expectations about what you guys were going to go do or what you might experience?
No, I didn't. We knew she just came off of the war. She was hit at Okinawa, and she came back for repair. That's when I got on there. It was just talking to the sailors that were on there. It's the only information we had. Of course, you couldn't believe all they told you either, but you had to learn on your own a lot. You grew up pretty fast.
But something else happened at Mare Island, right here in the East Bay. In fact, you can still visit Mare Island today. I understand they still have the chapel with the Tiffany windows in it and everything. The Indianapolis received some pretty important cargo there.
Well, we didn't know what it was. Well, the skipper didn't even know what it was. We're still in dry dock. Matter of fact, I was out on Liberty, and we got a call back. Everybody from Vallejo, Indianapolis, get back to the ship right away. And we didn't know what for. We stopped at Hunter's Point. And that's when we picked up the bomb, I guess. And we didn't know what it was until we didn't know until we were in a hospital in the Philippines that we had carried the bomb.
So what did you see at the time? It was just a giant crate they were craning on or something?
I remember in a port hangar, and it had Marine guards around it. You couldn't even touch the thing. We walked through the hangar deck, and the Marines had guns and everything. Couldn't even touch the box it was on. It's bigger than the table there. It seemed, I remember right, about 8 feet by 4 feet or something. It was big. Anyhow, we couldn't see it. We couldn't even touch the grate. So the Marines were the guns, you know.
So you must have known that it was important in some fashion if they're going to have Marines guarding it.
Yeah, well, even, like I say, the skipper didn't even know what he had until we delivered it. Of course, we didn't know until we dropped it.
and until you survived the ordeal you went through. But I have heard a few stories over the years that aboard ship, and you have almost 1,200 men on ship, that there was some scuttlebutt about what may be in that crate, and that maybe even guys were betting on what it would be.
A lot of guessing, mostly about girls, though.
They thought there were some girls inside of there?
No. I don't know. It was, guys are crazy, you know. I don't remember any of the stuff that I ever said was in there, but I walked by it many times. You couldn't even get near it. And they didn't know what they were guarding. They didn't know what it was.
I heard some people thought it was a bunch of beer in there.
Oh, well, that was guessed, too, a bunch of beer. We could have drank that beer, too.
I think you would have been willing to drink just about anything when you were in the water for 4.5 days.
Yeah, I could have used a few beers those days.
Well, what about for you? So I'm curious, you specifically, since you're 18 and this is your very first journey on this ship.
Yeah.
So you guys leave here and you deliver those components to Tinian. What was that journey like? Were there any experiences along the way that stand out?
Well, being on that ship and my first ship ever, big or small, sitting on a fantail and watching, we were doing 35 knots. I couldn't believe we were moving that fast. That big old, this thing is a big ship, doing 35 knots. It was a really experience for me. Of course, you couldn't even write home and tell about it because all your mail was special. I mean, everything, my mother would get a letter from me with everything crossed out. I couldn't tell her nothing. It was a big experience for me, but lucky to live through it.
And your role on the ship, were you a ship fitter? Is that right?
Yeah, I was a striker, you know.
Trying to become a ship fitter.
Yeah, yeah.
So that meant you would have repair jobs, hypothetically?
Repair a ship, yeah. Well, even we worked on the job, but we never held a rating. When you enlist, you don't write what you could do and couldn't do. And I ended up a ship fitter because I was mechanically inclined or something. It wasn't very long, though.
And what about if general quarters sounded? Where would your battle station be?
Well, I was a number 3 turret. I was of 8-inch guns. I was a loader. I never got to fire them. I threw the 3 bags of powder and then projectile. I seen them load. I never got to do it myself. I carried the powder bags, but that was it.
And before you took off or even en route, did you have a concept of the significance of the submarine threat and that you guys might be susceptible to that?
They didn't tell us too much, but they didn't want to scare us, I guess. Because they just got back from being hit, and they blew a number 1 and number 2 turret was blown right off the ship, I guess. So that was why she was in Maryland. They replaced the turrets and all the guns, and she took quite a hit off of Okinawa.
So you guys get to Tinian, and you see them unload this precious cargo, this top-secret package?
Yeah. We didn't know what it was, though. We didn't know till we got in a hospital in the Philippines what we had, what we did.
And when you're leaving Tinian, as I understand it, McVeigh requested an escort and was denied?
And he refused.
Uh-huh.
Didn't need one.
Didn't need one because there shouldn't be any submarines where you're going.
Well, they figured we could outrun any sub. She was pretty fast.
Yeah.
But you didn't know a sub was around, so she shot us third day out of Tinian.
Believe it or not, the last survivor of that enemy submarine was recently located. More on that to come, but it's time for our first break. If you would like to meet the last survivor of the USS Indianapolis' sinking, Harold Bray, and see that statue dedicated in Benicia, California, be there by 6 p.m. on July 7th. You'll find all the information online at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Giving you a heads up on the chance coming up July 7th in California's Bay Area to not only meet the last survivor of the USS Indianapolis, but witness the dedication of a statue honoring Harold Bray and his ship. Harold just turned 96, but he was barely 18 when he went to sleep aboard his cruiser on July 29th, 1945. Harold just turned 96, but he was barely 18 when he went to sleep aboard that cruiser on July 29th, 1945, having no earthly idea what would happen shortly after midnight.
Well, it was called hot bunk, you know. When you got out, another guy got in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 11 or 1,200 guys on that boat. It was a little overkill because, well, during the war, you just were there to replace somebody that got hit or something.
But typically, you would sleep below deck. But because it was so hot, they told you you can sleep topside?
Yeah. That's where I slept on number two turret. I took a sleeping bag and a pillow, and I put it on top of the turret. And I remember it right. I took my shoes off and my clothes on. And when about midnight, a little after midnight, we got hit. And when the torpedoes hit right on the opposite side of the ship of me, and it rolled me off of that, I was like a 10-foot drop.
Mm-hmm.
And I seen my shoes go over the side. And I was dressed with dungarees on and sleeping on the open like that. And I got down on the quarter deck, and it was just amazing. We carried like 87 Marines. It seemed like they were all right there on the quarter deck when I got down there. And they were starting to bail off. We were still on our way. I never got in the water till she was on her side. I was forward of the quarter deck. I got down on the quarter deck, and guys were going nuts or running all over the place. Some guys were hit. Some guys were bleeding, some guys. I stopped at the quarterdeck just to get my bearings, and my shop was at the Fantail. I was a ship fitter. So I made my way back to, I went through the hangar deck, and I grabbed some kind of tools, and I headed back to the Fantail. On the way back, I grabbed a life jacket. The guy was throwing them out of a pocket, and I got back to the Fantail, and there were three guys laying up against the bulkhead. One guy was bleeding pretty bad, and I gave him my life jacket. I helped him up to the lifeline. I made sure that he jumped off right forward of the propellers. We got him over the side where we were on the Fantail, so she was laying on her side in the water. I went back and got another one, and all that time, she was keeling over, and by the time I got back to the Fantail, she was on her side. And instead of floating off, I climbed over the rail and ran down the side of the ship to the quarter deck instead of floating off. I was going to stay dry as long as I could. When I went over the rail, I had to run forward to get away from the shafts. Screws were still turning. So I ran to the quarter deck. And that's where most of the guys were piling off there. They're all gathered there, but she was going down fast. And so I got in the water. And when I hit the water, somebody hit me and drove me down. I opened my eyes up in the water. I could see the guys, the lights. And, of course, stupid me opened my eyes in the salt water. That was not the thing to do. But I hit the surface. And when I come to the surface, I looked back, and she was up on her bow. She was halfway sunk already. Mm-hmm. And the guys were still coming off. And I swam away from her. I was kind of pulled, and I swam away from her and got on a raft. One guy was on, we had a raft. So we picked up, I think we picked up 80 guys that night. And then, of course, we had a crash net, and we tied it to the raft. And so the guys would hang on to something. And, of course, as the days go on, the guys got sick or died from wounds they had. And I came through it pretty good. I got my whole side was burned on my left side. But other than that, it was okay. But the guys were hurt pretty bad.
A couple of things I want to ask you about there. One, do I understand correctly that that was the very first night you were sleeping topside?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my deck was three decks down next to sick bay. My bunk was here where it was stack of three bunks, and I was on top bunk. The sick bay was right there. So.
And isn't that about where the torpedo hit?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it hit right, blew sick bay out of there.
If this were the night before,
yeah,
when you were sleeping down there, or if you hadn't decided to go topside that night, you wouldn't have made it out of there.
No, I don't know why. Well, because it's so hot.
Yeah.
And decided to sleep up on top of the steel deck rather than my bunk. That was kind of stupid, but it saved my life. If I was in my bunk area, I would have been killed right there. I would have never made it out.
And another thing I read about your experience, I think it might have been in Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent's book when they talk about your story, that before you abandoned ship, that I think it was Frenchie said to you, the ship's going down, and you couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Frenchie told me, you better get going, Bray. She's going down. I said, where is it going to go? Where is it going to go?
You had never considered that possibility.
Yeah.
That this beautiful ship could sink.
And at that point, we didn't know how bad she was hit. But she had taken two torpedoes, midship, one forward, and one midship. But she was still upright. But then the water came and started listing right away. When I went in the water, she was on her side. Of course, when I hit the water, somebody drove me down about 30, 40 feet. It seemed like I was never going to get back up there.
Well, and when you did, I think you found it wasn't all just water, right? There's a lot of oil in the water.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was about like 4 inches. Well, I had oil in my eyes, my ears, everything. It was a ruptured oil tank or something when we got hit.
I'm just trying to imagine what goes through the mind of an 18-year-old who is woken up by a torpedo hitting his ship, who falls to the next deck, whose shoes go overboard, who then he's going overboard, and now you're in the water in the dark, not knowing what's going on. What in the world were you thinking?
I don't know. I thought the Navy did that to everybody.
You and hundreds of other sailors aboard the Indianapolis are watching that ship go down, and you're in the water. Looking back now, you know what you went through over the 4 or 5 days that followed. But at that point, as you grab onto this raft and other guys are coming alongside, did you guys think you were going to be rescued? Was there any talk of what's going to happen next?
No, we didn't. Of course, we're by ourselves, no escort. We wondered about that, but they said, well, your ship was so fast it didn't need an escort. We were the fastest ship in the fleet at the time. But that was kind of ridiculous even. Most every ship had a destroyer with them, and we were by ourselves. And that was a big mistake, hindsight, you know.
And I'm guessing that you all would assume the ship was able to send out an SOS, a distress call.
Well, it would have, but CIC was hit, and it was just shut everything down. We didn't even get an abandoned ship.
But you guys in the water don't know that.
No.
So the reality is you've sunk, and no one in the Navy knows about it.
No, we're by ourselves.
And this would be just the first night, really just the morning, till the sun came up. Did that feel like it was days or weeks or years? I mean, what did that feel like as a teenager going through that?
I don't know. I thought Navy did that to everybody.
Breaking you in.
Yeah. I don't know what my thoughts were. I know it was kind of I don't remember even getting scared when we got hit. It seemed like I knew what to do, but nobody ever told me what to do.
And you're injured. You're burned?
Yeah. My whole left side was, my clothes were gone. I didn't blister much. My arm was blistered, my left, But it was all on my left side, but the salt water didn't do it any good.
So how much pain were you in?
But it burns, you know, until it scabbed over, and it was a couple of days. And the salt water wasn't no fun to be in with open sores.
Well, especially when there are sharks in the vicinity, too.
Yeah.
And I just want everybody to understand the situation. So you're burned. You're covered in oil. You have no food, no water?
No, no. Well, the oil kind of protected you from the sun. Because we were oil from head to toe, in eyes and mouth, tongue. Still taste it to this day.
Oof.
It was, you didn't have enough sense to close your mouth when you hit the water. I drank about a half a quart of oil, I think. But then you start throwing up, and after that's over, you're okay. But being just out of boot camp, that, you know, didn't expect anything like that.
And you mentioned, you know, more time that goes by, more guys latch on to this raft with the net attached,
right, yeah,
floating there. Did you guys talk to each other much?
Well, I don't remember what we talked about, but you didn't know anybody. I went on board with 10 other guys, and they weren't in that group I was in. We got split up in the water, three groups, and we were the biggest group, I guess. I don't know how many guys we ended up with, 80 guys in our, but when we got picked up, there was 18 of us 5 days later.
Well, and the tragic reality of the Indianapolis is that even though 900 of the almost 1,200 survived the sinking, by the time you're picked up almost 5 days later, there's only 316 of you,
yeah,
still alive.
Yeah.
So we know that over those days, there are a lot of things that were happening to claim these lives. What was your first awareness that sharks were in the area?
Well, the guys were getting hit. The guys that were bleeding, sharks were taking them first. But you weren't exempted. If you're on the outer edge of this group, I think we counted up the first morning, we were 80 of us. And then with this group, we had a crash net, you know what a floater net is?
Yeah.
We had one of those and a raft. We tied it together. They had something to hang on to because even with a Pequot life jacket, it was only good for so many hours, you know.
I think it was like 3 days, right? 72 hours or something?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And you had to have somebody or something to hang on to because we were in the water for over 100 hours. So I don't know what kept me alive, but I came through it pretty good shot, except for the burns. That was okay. There were flash burns. There weren't deep burns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of guys are a lot worse than me.
So you're 18 years old. You're burned. You're covered in oil. No food, no water. And now you're seeing other guys eaten by sharks right in front of your eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And the sharks had to come close to you, too.
Oh, so I got hit a couple of times. One got bumped in the rib cage. I thought he had me that time. But the face is so pointed. He just bumped me to see if I was still alive or something. And swam off. But that was the closest it came. That was pretty, pretty scary because guys were getting hit all the time. If you're any kind of wound and you're bleeding, you're just shark bait as well.
Well, and sharks weren't the only reason that guys died. Can you give us some other examples of what you saw happening that prevented some of those other sailors from surviving?
Well, the burns, some guys were really burned pretty bad. And then, of course, drinking that salt water, you go crazy. And they never taught us anything in boot camp about that, you know. Of course, I was out of boot camp a couple of months before I got on a ship. They never talked about, because she just got back from the war zone, and she just repaired. She was taking pretty hard at Okinawa. She took a couple of good hits there. That's when I got on her, when she got back from there. Then we went right back out there and got hit again.
So some of the guys around you, even on your raft, because you had no fresh water,
no,
and you're getting pounded by the sun while it's up, some guys resorted to drinking that salt water.
Oh, yeah.
And then they'd have hallucinations and maybe just go under or swim to some vision.
A lot of the guys just attack other guys, you know, they went crazy. And I just had enough sense to stay away from them. I don't know what made me do this, but I stayed by myself most of the time. Matter of fact, I swam away from the group and got a raft by myself for one day. And then I started picking up survivors, and they were just hanging on to each other.
As I just imagine, and it's really impossible for us to imagine going through this, because except for you guys, no one's gone through something this insane.
Yeah.
But I would imagine that initially, the first night, the first couple days maybe even, there's a fair amount of hope that someone's going to find you guys?
Yeah, we always, everybody, well, I don't know if we had any radio guys in our group or not, but they got a radio message off, but never was one, I don't think. We had airplanes go over every day, and they were way too high. And to the last day in the water, I was looking to the horizon and seeing this airplane just come, like it just came up like this out of the horizon and came right at us. And it wasn't looking for us. Flew right over us, and then we was screaming and splashing in the water, and they saw us, give us the wing thing. And he came back and did it again. And I seen him go straight up. And that's when he radioed what he had. And, of course, it was another day and a half before we got rescued. But we knew somebody knew where we were. But other than that, nobody knew where we got hit. Then they took us off the board in the Philippines, thinking they were already in there. We're supposed to report in. But I guess somebody messed up and took us off the board and didn't know where we were. Just a stroke of luck that we ever discovered.
And while we're talking about that moment, so I believe that was Chuck Gwynn, right, the pilot?
Yeah.
That saw you and tilted his wings at you. And I'm pretty sure that years later, at reunions, you got to meet him and shake his hand.
Oh, yeah, he came to the reunion. Him and his whole crew were there. First couple of years, of course, they were older, and they died pretty early, but he lived in San Jose. He died a few years ago, but he used to come up in my house. He was here a lot of times, but he just seen us by accident. He wasn't even looking for us.
What did you say to him the first time you got to meet him?
I think I kissed him. I don't know.
I don't know. Is there any doubt in your mind whether or not you'd be alive if he didn't see you?
Because we were in the water 4 days already. Nobody saw us. If they did, they ignored us. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was, when we first hit the water, there was like 1,100 of us in the water. If you were hurt, you weren't lasting, but it just died off every day. We were burying guys, and it was not a good sight to even think about, you know. It was quite an experience.
For those of us who weren't there, it's almost impossible to imagine. Harold Bray is the last man alive who can tell us what it was like. We'll explore more with Harold and hear more from filmmaker and author Sarah Vladek when we come back. You can meet both of them July 7th when the statue honoring Harold and the Indianapolis will be dedicated in Benicia, California. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode focusing on the saga of the USS Indianapolis. It's been nearly 78 years since that cruiser was torpedoed by the Japanese submarine I-58, sinking in just 12 minutes. Only 316 of the nearly 1,200 men aboard would ultimately survive, and now we're down to just one of them who can tell that story. 96-year-old Harold Bray of Benicia, California, the place where you'll be able to meet Harold and see this new statue unveiled July 7th.
For the last couple of days of July in 1945, and the first couple of days of August for that matter, Harold was in the water praying for rescue.
The plane comes over, so you know you've been spotted. But then it's another day and a half before they come back. Yeah. Seems like that might be the longest part of the whole thing.
Yeah. It was, where are they? Where are they? They're never here. Where are they? Of course, we were like 200 miles off of land, any land. So a ship, even traveling at 6 knots, takes a while to cover 200 miles. And at one point, there were 6 ships came to the rescue. And the Bassett was the one I got on. She was the first one there. And see, when I got picked up, I was by myself.
Well, and the reason you were by yourself, I think, is because you saw them drop something from the plane. They dropped a sono buoy, but you thought it was water?
Yeah. I hung on to that, till, but then I got on a raft by myself.
Okay. I think I read that you were actually asleep or had your eyes closed when they shined a light on your face?
Yeah. When they picked us up, yeah, I was sleeping and hanging on to whatever it was. I was tired. I was in the water 4 days already.
And you hadn't had anything to eat or drink?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing.
How much weight did you lose?
35 pounds or less.
In 5 days?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you must not have had much strength left when they're trying to pick you up.
No, I couldn't even lift my arms out of the water. They were there for a long time.
Can you describe for us what that feels like? With everything that you'd been through, when you finally are put on that LCVP going back to the Bassett, and you know for the first time you're actually going to live, what did that feel like?
Probably I was happy. It was just a miracle that anybody even found us. I don't think he was high enough to see us, but he seen the oil slick. We were in the oil, and that's how we got discovered.
He thought maybe he'd find a Japanese submarine to shoot at or something.
I guess that was what he said,
Was there ever a point in those 5 days where you thought about giving up?
I practically did, because I was getting tired. Of course, there was more room on the raft by that time. You know, I could sit. It was not a raft, it was a rope.
A rope net that you could get on top of and sit.
But you're still in the water
up
to your neck, holding your head up.
But you don't have to actively hold on with your arms anymore.
No, nothing. We're hanging on to each other until everybody was gone, you know. But just lucky. Just the guys that lived through it was just lucky.
And they took you to the hospital in the Philippines, I believe?
Samara, yeah.
How long did it take you to recover?
I don't know. They flew us to a hospital out of the Philippines and flew us to a hospital in Guam. So we were in Guam maybe a month and a half. I remember hospital 18. I never forget that. Then we went from there to San Diego. We spent some time in a hospital there.
It was while you were in the hospital, I think, that you first learned, hey, that crate that we took to Tinian, that was the atomic bomb that pretty much ended the war.
Yeah.
Was that kind of an eye-opening realization that that's what it was?
Well, nobody knew about the skipper didn't even know.
Yeah.
It's a big secret till they dropped it.
And speaking of the skipper, because there was such a great loss of life on your ship, it was such a disaster. So many things went wrong. People were looking for someone to blame.
Yeah. Well, he took the blame. He committed suicide for that reason, I guess. Because he was getting nasty letters from the mothers and dads. And we would have got hit no matter what. It was a... They were just out looking for us. I got to know them.
Yeah. And in fact, the commander of that Japanese submarine, I-58, Hashimoto, even came to the U.S. to testify in the court-martial that I would have gotten him whether he zigzagged or not.
Yeah.
And they still convicted him.
Yeah.
So you and your fellow survivors are living with that, bothered by that. He commits suicide in the 60s. And then in the 90s, a 12-year-old, I believe he was a 12-year-old kid in Florida, Hunter Scott, gets into this story and gets the Senate's attention, and they finally retry this case, basically, in Congress and clear his name, exonerate him.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you and your fellow survivors?
Well, finally got it right, you know. No matter what, we were just in a position where we were going to get hit no matter what. It was no accident the Japs were out looking for us. So I was just so lucky because no sleeping where I was supposed to be sleeping. That's where the 2 torpedoes hit, and I happened to be sleeping 3 decks higher, just a matter of luck.
There's a lot of what-ifs in your story.
Yeah.
How do you explain them all?
Just a matter of luck, that's all I can say. Oh, she's waving her hand. I had things to do.
Your wife believes that God was protecting you so she could marry you someday.
Yeah, that's what she says, yeah. It was just a matter of luck. They weren't even looking for us. I can see it today coming over the horizon, coming right at us. When he came over, I can see him do his wings. And he went out and came back, did it again, and he went straight up. That's when he radioed what he had. But he was our angel ever since. And as a matter of fact, that's what we called him, the angel. Because if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be talking. Just appreciate what I had. Because we lost 880 guys that never had that chance. Whoever got in the water, if they were hurt, they didn't live very long. And all I had was burns on my left side. I wasn't hurt very bad, but there was guys in some bad shape.
Another thing I'm thinking about is I imagine, you know, you and your law enforcement career spent a quarter century with the police department here in Benicia. So as a police officer and probably as a parent, I'm just imagining you didn't buy very many excuses that people tried to throw at you.
No. I really enjoyed being a cop.
Yeah.
I really did. In those days, we were boss on the street. We were the boss. Today, those guys don't have a chance out there now. But I really enjoyed being a cop, and I'd do it again if I could.
I guess floating for 5 days in the water with no food and water, losing 35 pounds over that stretch with sharks eating your buddies, I don't think anyone can tell a tougher story than that.
No, it was after you've seen the first couple, it's going to happen to you pretty soon. So I stayed by myself most of the time. I didn't gang up because the sharks seemed like they hit the guys that were ganged up together. I did have them poke me in the gut. They have a hard nose, you know. All it did was push me back into the crowd, so I came out so good. No open sores, just burns up my whole other side was burned. But a lot of guys were in bad shape. They didn't last very long. No matter what they do, you'll never can imagine what we went through while in the water. I can't even tell you what it was like. Nobody should go through stuff like that. You're dodging sharks, and then you're dodging guys that are going nuts, attacking you. I'm telling you, I'm just so lucky to get through that.
Well, and I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. And thank you for telling this story, because I know you've told it a ton of times, so you don't need to tell it to me and to the people listening right now, but it does so much for us to try to understand. How do you think we should remember? You mentioned the number a few minutes ago, 880 guys from your ship who died. How should we remember them?
These guys joined the Navy for a purpose. Our country was in trouble, so that's why we joined. Everybody should know the story. Just lucky that we were able to do what we did. Otherwise, we might have been talking Japanese. You never know.
Well, I was just thinking about that. Specifically, I'm thinking about all the guys who served in the war, Army, Navy, Marines, Air Corps, Coast Guard, who've told me that they felt Truman dropping the bomb saved their lives because we didn't have to invade Japan.
Yeah.
If you guys don't do your job and get it there, that doesn't happen.
No.
So you guys helped save a lot of lives.
That's what we were there for, you know. Of course, being 17, 18 years old, what else could you do? We had a good time doing it, except for those 5 days.
Except for those 5 days. One thing nothing has ever stolen from Harold Bray is his sense of humor. You can see for yourself July 7th when that statue is unveiled in Benicia. I want to bring back author and filmmaker Sarah Vladek now to keep peeling the onion on this incredible story of the USS Indianapolis.
Is there something that you're working on now or that you see happening now in terms of the legacy of this ship and its story that maybe you didn't see coming when you started out on this journey?
You know, there's still the ongoing effort to tell this story as a TV series or movie and that kind of thing, and to do it the justice it deserves. That hasn't been done yet. But beyond that, I think what's really been neat to see is that the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren have been working with, you know, the Legacy Organization, which is the nonprofit group that is kind of taking over now that we don't have the survivors to run the survivors organization, right? So now we're getting the next generation and the generation after that involved, and the fact that they still respect this story and the heroism and the values that these men fought and died for are being carried forward by generation after generation. It's so cool to see kids interested and wanting to know more and wanting to, you know, wear a shirt that has their great grandfather's name on it, or they'll do book reports or school programs, or they'll ask if they can show my documentary in their classroom. And we anyone out there who has classrooms from middle school through high school, if they want to show this, it's free to classrooms. So, you know, the kids will come in and they'll do this, and it's so neat to see the impact that this story still has on them multiple generations later. And, you know, I thought when all the survivors were gone that it would go away, but it seems to be that it's out there and more in the general public than it ever has been.
And Sarah, I know when you started this journey, you had no idea all the places it was going to take you. But still, now, all these years later, almost 80 years after this happened, there's still new connections being made. I understand just recently there's been a connection made with the last survivor of that Japanese submarine that sank the Indianapolis?
Yes, through a friend network, through the Legacy Organization, they were able to connect the last living survivor of I-58 Hashimoto submarine that sunk Indianapolis with the last survivor, Harold Bray. And so the gentleman's name is Kunshiro Kiyozumi. He wrote a letter to Harold, and Harold actually wrote an incredibly heartfelt letter back, just telling him that, you know, there is no animosity, there's no hatred, war is war, and we had to do what we had to do. But he extended invitations to the 94-year-old gentleman to come visit. But, you know, I don't know, maybe miracles will happen and that will come true. But it was just such a lovely moment to see these two, you know, last living survivors of their vessel connect and find peace in that. And it's just really cool to be part of that.
Wow, it's amazing. You never know. There's so many things that are possible if we just allow ourselves to believe that they could happen. And I hope you're right. I hope they do get to meet in person someday. Our listeners have a chance to meet Harold in person on July 7th. The Indianapolis reunion is happening that entire weekend. Of course, that's sold out by now. But these public events, the statue unveiling Friday night, and then on Sunday morning, there's something else with a special group that is honoring a legacy that probably hasn't been told as much as some of the other stories. What's the story there?
So most people are amazed to find out that there were 28 African-American sailors aboard Indianapolis, and not one of them survived. And so, unfortunately, we've never really been able to tell their stories in their entirety because, obviously, they weren't here to tell them. But in the last couple of years, actually, we were, you know, doing an effort to find a photograph of every single sailor of Indianapolis on the final sailing. And what came from that was an effort to get to know all the men and who they were. And we realized that many of those men, the African-American sailors and Native American sailor and Filipino sailors, and they really just never had their stories told. Recently, that turned actually into a book, and we were able to locate quite a few of the families of the men who didn't survive, and they came together and they put a book together called Heroes in the Shadows. And those families will be attending the reunion and talking about their loved ones and these 28 men who never came home. And they were, you know, one of them was Captain McVeigh's steward. Many of them had served on the ship since, you know, like prior to the war years. So they all have these incredible stories and backgrounds that no one's ever heard before. And this is the first time they're going to be sharing about them. So the book just came out, and, you know, the families will be there to talk about it on Sunday morning.
So that'll be Sunday morning, July the 9th at 8:30?
Correct, at 8:30, and it'll be at the clock tower. So essentially, it's the same area as where the statue unveiling will be. This will be inside the building at the clock tower, and the statue unveiling will be in the courtyard in front of it.
Well, fantastic. I know a lot of our listeners are marking their calendars right now and preparing to be there, and maybe they'll bump into you as well. I just want to say thank you, Sarah, for your example, for your dedication. You know, it's just amazing to watch how this story continues to mushroom out and become even bigger than I think we all understood it was, and it makes me wonder what might be next. Is there a final thought that you'd like to share with our listeners about why this story of the Indianapolis and the men aboard that ship, why that still matters today?
I think it represents so much of who we were and who we are and who we can be. You know, these men were facing times that were very challenging, much like today, and they chose to stand up and do the right thing. They chose to fight. They chose to fight for the man and the woman next to them and defend something that's very important. We might take those things for granted right now because we're not in wartime, but we're facing, you know, other challenges out there. And I think we can all look to that for inspiration, and that those men rose up against so many incredible things to fight for what was right. And they were just everyday boys who went to war and did what they had to do for their country. And I think a lot of us can find heroes in that and hopefully reflect that in our own days and just do a little bit better.
Amen to that. And I know Sarah Vladek is living up to that. The rest of us can try to do the same. Thanks to Sarah and, of course, to Harold Bray. They'll be there July 7th in Benicia, California. I'm going to do my best to be there as well. And again, you can find all that information at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.